listen, brother, let's get together and unify. Trouble, trouble,
Radio Basics. And there's always a message involved.
FM. This is Kabir here in the studio with
Justin Panos, David Chin.
Please only say your own name.
Randy. What else we got in here? We got Mr. Alok Premji from Justice for Ahui campaign against police brutality. We got some youth, some outstanding youth, gonna speak on some issues as well with regard to no cops. Right? Is that what we're doing here today?
That's it.
And yeah. I guess we should get into the show. This is our March 16th edition, Radio Basics.
Yes, St. Patrick's Day. We got a special edition of the show today, and instead of going into international and local headlines at the beginning, we're going to say those at the very end of the show. And so right now we're going to go into the campaign against police brutality, but before that, after that, we're going to be talking to Keith Harmon Snow from Massachusetts. He's a professor from Massachusetts. He's going to be talking about the situation in Sudan and Africa. Sudan's been in the news recently with the kidnapping of the Canadian aid worker there, and with the decision to imprison or to have the arrest warrant put out for the president of Sudan. We're going to be talking about the situation there.
Yeah, and even recent developments out in Montreal. Recently was police used tear gas on police brutality protesters. Most of the 221 people arrested during the melee on Sunday were released after receiving a fine or under a promise to appear in court at a later date. But at least 17 are facing more serious charges and were scheduled to go before a judge on Monday. The event, organized by the Montreal group Collective Against Police Brutality, bears witness to how the police resort to authoritarian measures. The police arrived in full riot gear, which undoubtedly projects a riotous disposition towards the protesters and feelings of authority, power, and masculine strength. The police used tear gas and other chemical and harmful substances on the protesters, who at worst were engaging in petty vandalism or holding sticks from trees. The disproportionate use of force by the police bears witness to the increasingly brutal nature of police tactics. Mayor Gerald Tremblay said that he was disappointed in the way the protest transpired, and he said that he's considering a new bylaw that may oblige organizers to plan and divulge their route beforehand. And even in Toronto, in Scarborough, Weston High, all over, we're having cops in the schools, and you know, that also is a form of police brutality, with just a intimidation that they project out towards people. And you know, they have guns and stuff, and we're fortunate today to have two youths in the studio, and they're going to talk about some experiences. Also, we got Alok and Kabir too. They're involved in a no cops program. So, yeah, do you guys want to introduce yourself?
My name is Massive.
My name is John.
Yeah. Yo, welcome to Radio Basics. Thanks for coming on here. You know, these guys, they're gonna spit their narrative out, because you know, like the voice of the kids are never heard in this, and it wasn't ever voted on, it wasn't ever you know, decided by the people that police would be in these schools. You know, it was an authoritarian measure. It was just we're gonna put them here whether you like it or not. So, Kabir, do you want to like talk about some developments that's been going on in the school and what No Cops is?
The program about police in schools?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, definitely, just to set up the interview. So this was a program started back in September. This mm-hmm. September, there was to put police in about 30 high schools throughout Toronto, Catholic schools and public schools. The decision was made in the summer, basically by the police board, by Police Chief Bill Blair, and the Toronto District School Board, without any kind of consultation with the community. And yeah, and so now we have armed cops in about 30 Toronto high schools. Obviously, the majority of the high schools are in priority areas serving racialized communities, poor communities. Mm-hmm. And so this was a targeted method to target the kids from those communities who already face police violence and brutality in their own neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And now they have to face that same kind of surveillance at school. But so, let's get on to the guests. So why don't you tell us what school you go to?
You go to Western High, Western Collegiate Institute.
Yeah.
That's located on
Pine Street, 100 Pine Street.
Yeah, so what's your guys like, how would you describe the police presence in the schools? Like, what do they look like? What are they wearing? How do they act towards kids? Like,
well, basically, the way that he's going about in our school is like, he's there to, like, we're jail members.
Mm-hmm.
You understand?
Yeah.
Like, we're supposed to feel imitated, basically, on the way he dresses. He has a gun
mm-hmm.
in school.
Yeah, exactly.
He's walking around in uniform, which I don't think is right. One, because he says he's a resource officer.
Mm-hmm.
One, resource officer is, come on, resource officer, police officer.
Yeah.
Those are two different things.
So what, did you get like a formal introduction to this guy? Did he like...
Yeah, one day he comes on stage and he tells us, I'm not an officer, I'm a resource officer.
Yeah. So what's this? He's supposed to be someone to, I guess, talk to, or
resource, you know? Yeah. Back in the dictionary, is somebody you refer to,
yeah.
Right? Somebody you can go to in need of help or this and that.
So how accessible is this guy? Is he around?
To tell you the truth, as my partner over here can say, he goes to the same school.
Yeah.
I have not seen him only once.
Really?
Only once.
That's
and that's when I had swimming.
Hmm.
To tell you the truth. That's in gym class.
So yeah,
he's basically staying in the office all day.
Yes, it's either that or you don't see his face.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or he's at the swimming pool, it looks like.
Yeah.
That's
perverted. So there's really no opportunities to contact him or approach him as a resource if you have an issue, then no.
And a resource officer, as a resource officer in the school, I think if they're paying him
mm-hmm.
and our tax money is going to him, I think they should at least, as a resource officer, help the kids. You
know
what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's being a resource on basically being there for the people, mm-hmm. right? So you got kids who are failing. Make up with all the contacts that you have of an officer and help the children in need.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are you there for? Why are you calling yourself a resource officer?
Yeah, well,
you're only there if a fight breaks out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I mean, why wouldn't they just...
And that's like once in a while.
Yeah.
You don't see a lot of fights up in Weston.
Yeah.
So Max, maybe you could talk about the incident that happened just a little while ago where there was a fight in the school. So when does the police officer show his face? What's the result of that? How is his interaction with students?
Well, my take on this is like, the only time I actually see this officer in my school is like when there's a fight or like there's some kind of major conflict going on in the school. That's the only time I really see this guy around. Or like if he's on a lunch break and like in the staff office or somewhere like that. That's the only time I really see him. And like personally, he's not involved with the students at all. Like mostly all the kids at my school, they personally, like, I think they fear him because like he's walking around with a gun
mm-hmm.
and like he has taser, he has everything like a normal cop. It's just to say he's just inside of a building. Like personally, when I see him myself, I'm like, wow, if a cop could walk around a school with a gun, then come on now, like, you're just showing kids that you could do the same thing. Like, I don't think that's the right way for, like, the board and, the Toronto Police Service, like, to go about doing that thing. I think that we should just start, like, worrying about, like, where kids actually live and what school they should be going to. Like, a lot of kids are coming from different areas and going to, like, the wrong district school. Like, that's just corrupt. That's what the board needs to really pay attention to. Like, and they're not paying attention to that, like... Really, like, we just need to just pay attention to, like, where kids are living, or, like, you know, and take real, like, focus on that stuff on it.
So
you're saying that's one cause of violence in schools, or a possible cause of violence is that there's kids coming from different areas who don't know each other coming into school.
Yeah, and like, if you, for instance, like, say if you rep a different neighborhood, like, a man might feel, like, threatened that you're coming to his school, and, like, he might want to fight you and stuff like that, so... That's a big issue, like, and the board needs to look into that and stop, like, stop saying that, there's, like, the reason for violence is that kids are, like, trying to, like, wild out and stuff in school.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's interesting. We got to go to a commercial break, unfortunately, but we'll pick up on this when we come back.
So we'll come back with John and Massive after the commercial break. Maxon called him by the wrong name. I don't know where that came out.
All right, we'll be back.
Volunteering.
All right, you're back. Listening to Radio Basics, 105.5 FM, here with Massive and John. So why don't you tell us, actually, you know what, I'm going to let myself and Alok, we'll talk about the time we were at your school this past week, the week before coming there, and we had a little conversation with the officer, the resource officer at your school.
Well, basically, we had a petition going around the school. We have a petition going around Weston. The petition is in regards to removing the police officer from the school, the SRO, Special Resource Officer, and demanding a meaningful discussion, like a community forum, around that very issue to see whether the general consensus of the community wants police in the schools or not. So, you know, we were there, we set up at lunch, and the SRO officer came, and he began to speak with us. And, you know, the first 10 seconds of the conversation with the cop, it was actually back and forth. And then after he read the petition, the cop went basically solo, and he began to dominate the conversation. And he was asking questions, but they were, you know, he wouldn't let us answer them. And they were rhetorical questions. And he began to become a lot more intimidating. His demeanor switched. And he began to say that as a 9-year veteran on the force, he has never seen excessive police violence. He has not seen police harassment, nor has he seen murder. And then the only time he did actually ask a question and he allowed us to answer was saying, where has he seen, you know, where have there been cases of police murder? And I, you know, named three right off the bat with Alwi El Nadir.
Three that happened in the past three years.
Jeffrey Riotica and Byron De Basige for stealing two lemons. And so he said he never heard of that. And anyway, he began his arrogant ways and began to intimidate us again. So we just had to leave the situation. 2 minutes later, John comes over, and who's in the studio right now. And he had a video that he captured with his cell phone. And John, why don't you describe what the video showed? Because that actual SRO officer we were speaking to was the main star of that.
And this is a guy that says he's never ever seen any case of police misconduct in 19 years.
Well, what I caught on video was there was a conflict at my school that broke out, and like a lot of kids was going crazy in the school, and the police officer was trying to get kids out of the school, and the way he was like taking like full domination over the kids at my school was like totally like real, like we never seen it at our school before. Like many people at our school, we're all cool with each other, we don't like, there's not that much like hate in our school. So we saw this, what I got on my camera phone is that he grabbed like two, like a female, and he grabbed her by her neck and he pushed her out the door in the front of my entrance at my school. And later after that, he grabbed this kid, he grabbed this boy by his jacket, and like he just it looked like abuse from like watching from like live and looking at the video after. And like it was like I thought that kid did something wrong. The kid was just trying to like leave the school at the same time too, because it was chaos in that little hallway in front of my school. And like I don't even know, like,
you got anything to add, Matthew?
Well, tell you the truth, right? I saw the video too. Mm-hmm. And I saw both of my friends who did get suspended for their reactions to that, basically that officer pushing them out the door. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't see in the need of you getting people out. You ain't, it's simple, buddy. All you gotta do is tell me, may you please exit the building.
Yeah.
You ain't gotta touch me in any sort of way.
Yeah.
And the thing is, we live in a neighborhood that when an officer is pushing on you, what else is you gonna do, right?
Yeah.
You're feeling imitated, right?
Yeah.
So basically, they acted in the wrong manner. And they said, why are you touching me? All right? You tell me, if I touched you in the wrong manner, how would you feel? And that's something that the officer should have asked himself, right?
Yeah, and it's a problem like with police, because they feel they're the authority and they should always be in control. And when they lose that control, right, they feel
nobody.
Like they have free rein just to, you know, free reign to gain that control back, right? And so yeah, you want
to
add something
to add to that video? So when I was watching that video, he grabbed the girl by her neck and threw her outside, and then the two guys who were actually standing up for the girls, saying that, you know, you can't be touching them like that, you can't be touching us like that, they were again gripped up by their jacket and by their scruff and thrown out. And it turned out that those students were suspended. All right, for, you know, essentially standing up for a woman.
Insubordination.
Yeah. Insubordinate by a very strong police officer who wears a bulletproof vest and a gun. And every taser and the whole works, you know, that you see cops on the street with.
What is he called again, Loke?
He's called a special resource officer. And you guys have been telling us that this officer sits in the office, and the only time he actually comes out is in time of conflict or when kids are, you know, wandering the hallways when they should be in class, right?
So you tell me, Toronto, what do you think a resource in the dictionary means?
Yeah.
Okay?
You know, there has to be a meaningful discussion where the community is consulted. This decision to place police was initiated by the Toronto Police, and the decision was finally made by the TDSB at the executive level without any proper consultation with the community. Jane and Finch, for example, is the one community that actually had a decent trustee and ward counselor that actually stood up and asked the community, hey, do you feel that we need police in our schools? And C.W. Jeffries, the one school that actually sparked this debate of placing police in the schools, which was documented in the Falconer Report.
Jordan Manners killing last fall.
That's right. Which actually, the Falconer Report, which never said that their police are necessary in the schools. Nevertheless, Bill Blair, chief of police, placed these police in schools because, you know, the Toronto police budget is $2 billion a year, our Torontonian tax money. Meanwhile, housing and our schooling and, the fundamental pillars of our welfare state are deteriorating by the second and causing impoverished conditions more and more. They're building a youth super jail where, you know, kids don't have many opportunities, so they result to, you know, selling drugs and, you know, being on the street more often than being at home, which is being torn apart by this institution that we live in. I think I'm running a too much, but
something that Loke is touching upon is they say they want the family members at home. Basically, that is your mother and your father. Am I right?
Yeah.
They have family day for that same reason. One day of the full year, buddy, come on. You expect to get those kids off the streets? The one thing you can do is, okay, they say in Scarborough, in Brampton, they say they don't have the money so they can put kids into certain community centers. So they can at least basketball, tennis, something that the kids can relate to and have fun, right? Than being on the streets and trying to sell drugs for money to have that little change in their pocket so they can spend on maybe a gun, right? To show that, hey, I am the big man, okay? Yeah. I can't be a lawyer, but I can show you. And I can show anyone else that I can be a big man.
Yeah, and it also is like all the corporate mainstream presses, right? They show figures, rap figures with guns, you know, and money and stuff, and right, and they project this image out at people, and they never would put on any conscious hip hop of like bettering yourself, right? They always kind of go right towards the money makers and the guys toting guns and stuff and being oppressive to women. So you want to add something, John?
Like, I just want to know, why are the cops in our schools like dressed in like a uniform? Like, why can't they come to like our school? Our school has no uniform, so why can't they approach our school like in civilian clothes? Why can't they just do that? Yeah. Be on the cop, like, you know, do something like that. Like, come to our school, approach our students like that, and then with like, you know, there'll be a cooperation in our school. Like, they're just coming to our school dressed up in like gears and stuff, like, you're looking like if they're like there for a purpose, like, oh, some kid probably did something wrong, there was like a murder or something, there was like shooting or there was stabbing or something. Like, I just want to know personally why the cops come in our school dressed up in like big, like, you know, in a suit, like, you know, we should just like, they should, you should have personally come there like a, like, you know, like how the principal dressed in a suit, like, you know, like
how the students.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, it sets up like a difference, right? Like a difference that we are we're a hierarchy, right? And even the hierarchy, like in that person's mind, the higher figure, right? he's got to be in control. And when he's out of control, right, you never know.
The cop actually said, well, it's these, when he was talking about these 13 high-risk communities, the priority neighborhoods, he goes, that these people make their choice. And first of all, he's distinguishing himself and separating himself from these people, you know. So obviously there is a hierarchy relationship in his mind with people, and so he feels that he is superior.
An inferiority projected onto those people in those neighborhoods. So, you know, when they were introducing this program, the TDSB and the police force, one of the reasons for having police in schools, they said, is that kids have a very negative image of police. You know, they dislike the police. And they attribute this to somehow, you know, culture. They get this from rap music or whatever. But why don't you guys talk to us? Why is it that there are kids, particularly in these 13 neighborhoods and other areas in Toronto? Why is it that they don't? Why is it that police don't have a good reputation in these areas? Are police there like they are in some wealthy white communities, protecting people, doing their job, or what are they actually doing in these areas?
They're actually, the police there in those neighborhoods are actually there to target the kids. Like, most kids there, like, you'll actually hear them talking about, like, stuff like, oh, a cop pulled me over, and you were asking me, why am I standing here? Like, I personally think that a cop don't need to be asking you why you're standing there. Like only if there's some kind of warrant out for someone, like, to be, like, standing at that particular spot, like, then a cop should actually be asking you, like, why are you standing there? Like, there's no need for a cop to be asking why you standing in a specific spot for no reason. Everyone has a freedom, like, to stand anywhere in Canada. We have a freedom to speak. We have a freedom to do whatever we want to do. So, like, cops are just, like, that's the thing that most kids have. Like, when I was, like, 13, personally, I used to live in Jane and Finch, and, like, I was riding my bike, and it was summertime, and it was only 7 o'clock, okay? And I was riding around on a Sunday afternoon in Jane and Finch Mall in the parking lot, and a cop pulled me over, and he asked me, why am I riding my bike here? I'm like, it's an open space. Where do you want me to go ride my bike? Do you see any BMX place for me to go ride my bike? And he's asking me, he's telling me to leave for what? And I'm, like, riding around. I'm not even causing any problem. Like, the way he approached me, he's like, and disrespecting me, using foul language and stuff like that. I was like, wow, a cop really have the authority to really approach me like that? Like, what is it, my, is it like my race, is it my culture, is it what? Like, you know?
No, I think basically it's our age. One is because we don't have that. Like, from where I come from, I know if someone bigger was talking to me, like a father figure, right, he has more authority to talk to me than if I was going to talk to him. Mm-hmm. Right, if I'm talking to him, it's like bare nonsense, right?
Yeah.
But he talking to me is like he's like he's God.
Yeah.
Am I right? So then, that's what they're acting like. It's like they're bigger than us, and we have no say.
Yeah.
But we're here to say that we do have a say, right? That we should have a say. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. So the whole thing about that they want to, you know, kind of gain some sort of trust between the youth and the police. What's your experience? Have you guys trust them, or what's the sort of sentiment?
I truly do not. Reasons, there are many reasons. I say that basically this world is full of low-income people and high-class people. All right? The high-class is the people with the money, and they can bribe, right? The low class, if you ain't got money, buddy, you better be lucky that you better scrape up a dollar to pay that high class person, because you ain't getting nothing. And that's the truth.
Yeah. All right, so any final words? We got to wrap up this section of the show. John or Massive, anything else you want to get in your mind while you got the airwaves?
More cops.
There you go. I think That says it all. Anything you guys want
to
add?
If you're interested in seeing that video, we're going to be posting it on the Basics website. And, so the video of the police harassment.
Also on Facebook, we do have an account and a group, and it's called...
Just type in Police in Schools, Weston, and you'll find the group.
And that is the Facebook account. And you can add that up and see where we will be located and what are the causes we are fighting. Yeah.
Because we're not going away. special resource officer located in Weston. And we're going to get the community very much involved and you out of there. As
no
well as
cops.
All the schools.
If you're listening to this program, we're coming for you.
No, no, not like that.
With our petition. Okay, all right. So, yeah. All right, so that was an interview with two youth. Right now, we're going to go to a song called Ships Ahoy by the Marksmen. And, you know, this song is to pay homage to the struggles of Ireland, who faced 800 years of colonization, and tomorrow St. Patrick's Day. So... Yes, Radio Basics, we are back. Right now, we got a privilege in the studio right now. We're going to talk with Keith Harmon Snow, who is an individual research reporter, and he does all types of work. Kabir's going to give a little intro on him, but what basically the topic is Sudan and Darfur and sort of what the media has been saying, and I'll let Kabir get into it.
Definitely. So the U.S.-led and the Canadian-endorsed campaign to destabilize and overthrow the elected government of Sudan was stepped up this past week when the International Criminal Court announced an arrest warrant or put out an arrest warrant for the president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir. The ICC made the announcement last Wednesday, accusing Bashir of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity against the population in the West Sudanese province of Darfur. The conflict in Darfur began back in 2003 when the heavily armed Justice and Equality Movement and the Sudanese Liberation Army launched a so-called rebellion against the government, both forces being funded and supported by Israel, the United States, and the Ugandan dictatorship and various other U.S. puppet regimes in Africa. Many suggest the ICC, which has never moved to prosecute the notorious rebel leaders or the international regimes that arm and fund them, is trying to further destabilize Sudan's central government and derail recent initiatives aimed at resolving the conflict. In response to the arrest warrant, President al-Bashir expelled some 13 Western-based aid groups, which in reality have served as yet another front to undermine the Sudanese government and support and legitimize the insurrection. Also this past week, three workers with Doctors Without Borders, including a Canadian, were kidnapped and held for 3 days before being released on Saturday. To provide some insight into the ongoing situation in Sudan and to discuss the most recent acceleration in plans to overthrow the government of Sudan, we're joined on the line by Keith Harmon Snow. Keith is an award-winning investigative journalist and photographer. His many articles and reports have challenged and debunked the accepted reactionary narratives on a number of key current and historic events, particularly in Central and West Africa. He continues to be one of the few truly independent journalists covering events on the continent of Africa, and so it's an honor to have him join us from Massachusetts today. Hello, Keith, and thanks so much for coming on the program today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Kabir. Thanks so much to your listeners as well.
Definitely. So to begin, what do you make of this ICC arrest warrant put out for the president of Sudan?
Well, it's just another form of U.S. foreign policy. It's a kind of a stick. We'll beat you over the head with accusations of genocide and arrest you for war crimes if you don't do what we want. And that's exactly what's happening here. It doesn't really say much about whether President Bashir is guilty as charged for genocide or war crimes or crimes against humanity. And it wouldn't say much about that if they hauled in President Mugabe, or if they hauled in President Kabila, or if they hauled in President Kagame. It's not about that. It's about demonizing certain people in the world to serve the interests of the United States, or the most powerful. It's the most powerful serving the interests of the most powerful by punishing certain people and letting other people who are completely criminally guilty off the hook. So my recent slogan has become Bush before Bashir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And even in with recent developments with like actual CIA documents coming out, all the documents being released on the torture memos, basically, as they're being referred to, right? That incriminates the highest levels of U.S. government, and also the CIA developments where they destroyed about 100 tapes and things like this, and that goes silent, right?
Yeah, for example, some of the worst war criminals in the world are currently sitting in the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
And they aren't never going to be charged. They are never going to be charged, as far as I can see, at least not on the current scheme of affairs. It's easier to make it look like there's some change coming to the world when they arrest a guy like Bernie Madoff and let all the other people off the hook and make it look like there's been some sort of a reform mm-hmm. when certain corporations are bailed out. So, you can immediately shift the whole Bashir thing into the economic sector in the United States and make comparisons between how Bashir is punished or how Madoff is arrested. That's an example of a fall guy.
Mm-hmm.
Bashir is the fall guy in Sudan. What's really going on in Sudan, as you introduced to your readers, listeners, the justice and equality movement is backed by Israel and the United States,
mm-hmm.
and the United States also backs the Sudan Liberation Army. And this has been going on for years. And the way that people should see it is as a guerrilla warfare, a low-intensity guerrilla war, just like we saw, or people have come to understand, happened in Honduras and Guatemala
mm-hmm.
and Nicaragua in the 1980s. And
mm-hmm.
this includes, major brutality committed by U.S.-backed forces proxy forces. And these forces are never named or never brought to account. It's always that nasty government of Sudan is committing these atrocities. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the atrocities in many cases are being committed by the U.S.-backed proxy forces, and they're being blamed on Bashir, because all you got to do is create a few dead bodies and call in the Western press and point the cameras at the dead bodies and say, see what that nasty government of Sudan did. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of historical evidence that this has happened. Africa as well as other places.
You recently wrote an article where you were discussing the so-called Janjaweed militia, this militia that they've going, you know, gone on and on about, these Arabs on horse, you know, horsemen that they've been, you know, it's been sensationalized in the media being armed by the government of Sudan, when in fact there's information coming out that these are being in fact armed by the rebel factions, so-called rebel factions in Sudan.
It's the same with the Interahamwe, the so-called militias
in Rwanda.
Bloody militias in Rwanda, who were always, after the 1994 cataclysm, we've always heard over and over, the propaganda system has drummed into the American public's head that the Interahamwe were the responsible for the organized genocide in Rwanda. All of that is nonsense. It's the Interahamwe, in fact, included some very, very high-level Tutsis. And, of course, if you remember the Tutsi Hutu propaganda, it's all that the Hutus committed genocide against the Tutsis. Mm-hmm. Well, if you turn it around and take it up to Sudan, we find the Arabs on horses committing genocide against the black Africans. And it's the way that the West reduces these conflicts in the African or the non-white world to some sort of a stereotype that works very quickly in the media to give the American public exactly what they think, which is that it's some racist war over there that has nothing to do with us.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Well, Keith, we're going to pick up on this right after our commercial, a short commercial break, so please stay on the line.
Sure, thank you.
All right, we are back. Sorry about that. We lost Keith for a second, and we got him back. Are you there, Keith?
I'm here, thank you. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened.
Oh, yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah, live radio. So, yeah, seriously. Okay, so, yeah, I'm going to pick up on where you left off, sort of the race question, how they just project images of people on the media, right? And sort of don't even give any historical background. It's really ahistorical, like you said. They can show a couple dead bodies, you know, show a couple faces, and sort of play off the stereotypes that are already embedded in society, right?
Exactly. You know, some of the best news I've heard in recent times was today when I heard that the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, the largest newspaper in America to close recently, has now closed. And that's fantastic, because this is just plain propaganda. And the newspapers use this sort of stuff. They use racist stereotypes about Tutsis and Hutus and Mai Mai and all kinds of malicious stuff. And that's exactly what they've done on Sudan without giving us any of the real information and what's going on. And, you know, and the racial thing plays out on another level, as you pointed out at the beginning, where they've arrested now five or six black men are being held in the International Criminal Court, and they've sent out an arrest warrant for Bashir, who's the only sitting president to ever been issued an indictment, mm-hmm. seven indictments, in fact. And it's really interesting. People should look at that. Seven black men have been indicted by the International Criminal Court in the world, mm-hmm. a world run by white people.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. And if people don't accept that, then they have a serious problem inside themselves with their own internalized white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And, you know, I think that's one thing you pointed out. Any analysis of the situation is completely ignored, as in the case of Rwanda, which, as you've correctly pointed out, was a low-intensity coup d'etat that took place through the terrorist group, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, that now forms the government. Again, you know, we're targeting Bashir, we're targeting Mugabe. We don't look at one of the most horrific human rights abuses in Africa, people like Kagame. Were recently freed a Ukrainian ship that contained weapons, tanks, rockets, munitions, all destined for Darfur, and that was owned by an Israeli businessman, a former Mossad agent called Vadim Alperin. Tell us a little bit about that incident and what it speaks to in terms of the larger involvement of the West in this conflict.
Everything about what you just said has been confirmed, except the fact that he was a Mossad agent. And I actually reported that he was a purported Mossad agent, because I can't confirm it, so I want to make that correction. I perhaps could have left that out. But in any case, he was an Israeli businessman with ties to the weapons community, and he was importing some 32 T-73 tanks, which are former Russian Soviet tanks. And that stuff was headed to Mombasa, Kenya. And to label the Somali people off the coast of Somalia operating in the maritime waters there as pirates is another racist stereotype, by the way. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, they would be called pirates by any reasonable definition at this point because they board and take over ships. But it's important to note that the piracy movement arose out of local militia fishermen who were fighting for the cleanliness of their water when these ships were coming from the west and dumping toxic waste into the ocean. So that's where the piracy movement came from. Mm-hmm. And they boarded this ship recently, and it became more about ransom and taking ships and earning money and involving weaponry and factions being funded by different governments, including the government of Sudan or the government of Ethiopia or whoever. And so they boarded this one ship that did indeed have all these Israeli weapons. And if it hadn't happened, we wouldn't know that it had this Israeli-owned ship had all these weapons on it. So, yeah, that's an important point. And it was going to Sudan.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Somalia, just another example of another overthrow conducted by the United States and their client regimes in Africa, Ethiopia, populist, we can have an argument about the human rights or whatever situation there, but this was a populist government in Somalia, the Islamic Courts Union, that was once again, you know, overthrown by imperialism.
Mm-hmm. Somalia is another perfect example of ongoing American terrorism at this very moment, trying to destabilize and overthrow any factions that serve anything other than what the United States wants, which, of course, Somalia is all about oil, access to the ocean for Ethiopia, but also oil. So, yeah, it's a perfect point. The number of three top dictators in the world, perhaps, you know, quite legitimately, or certainly in Africa, other than George Bush, Bill Clinton, and, you know, these guys, Dick Cheney, could very well be President Museveni, President Kagame, and President Meles Zenawi in Ethiopia. And all these governments are involved in the war in Sudan, but we don't ever get that piece. All we get is, as we pointed out, this stuff about Janjaweed on horses, which is nonsense.
Yeah, I want to just go to that point about oil capitalism and then relate this to the larger geopolitical question. While they show it sort of as an isolated incident, maybe between two tribal factions, and they can play off old colonial tropes, what are the larger geopolitical implications here?
Well, as I think you guys have covered previously, but the Sudan issue is, Sudan's a very important, pivotal place for the United States. The U.S. doesn't have control and wants control. We control South Sudan already, and they want to control North Sudan, and they're fighting. Darfur becomes the flashpoint for that. Darfur itself has five or six major resources up for grabs, including it's one gigantic oil field. That's most important, or very important. It's also the world's two-thirds of world supply of gum arabic is in Darfur, and it's the best quality gum arabic in the world, and gum arabic is essential for Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and Ben & Jerry's ice cream. And Ben & Jerry's, of course, is controlled by this nasty corporation called Unilever. And then you've got the oil runs right straight down. And by the way, the conflict in the Congo and Uganda, northern Uganda, revolves around as well. They're all connected to what's going on in Sudan because it all involves these different factions fighting for control of oil. And so in Sudan, you've also got copper and uranium. And then these vast plantations, as I said, one for gum arabic, but also sugar. The Sudan is the fourth largest sugar producer in the world, and the United States sugar industry doesn't like that. And they also don't operate within the U.S. monetary system. So the United States and its allies don't like that either. So that means they have to get rid of this government, and that's what they're trying to do. And basically, as I said, we already control South Sudan, the United States does, with Israel and its partners, and they now want to control North Sudan. And that also, of course, becomes all about this war on Islam, which we have going on, where anything Islamic is defined as terrorism, and anything Christian is defined as good. So it's good versus evil. The Christians in the south of Sudan, the evil terrorist Arabs in the north. And so it's another inroad to control the Arab world, or to dominate the Arab world, which, of course, is what Iraq, Afghanistan, and the low-intensity conflicts in Syria and Yemen are all about as well.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and even in Gaza and Lebanon too, right?
Well, of course, I'm sorry. Forgive me for forgetting the people of Gaza.
Well, there's almost too much to cover all in one. I want to go back to a point you made about Ben & Jerry's, and also link this to in Congo. So I'm just picturing when you were saying that, just the people that are walking down Queen Street, which is a major city or major street in Toronto, talking on their cell phones, eating their Ben & Jerry's ice cream, thinking that has nothing to do with anything going on, right? That is just that's just the Toronto life isolated from all the world events, and you know, you put it into context really well. And on the food topic, I want you to talk about aid, because you talk a lot about foreign aid as a weapon and food aid as a weapon. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I don't have any sympathy for these three Doctors Without Borders, so-called aid workers who were kidnapped. I mean, I hope the people will be released, and I do have sympathy for their families. I mean, I have sympathy for them. Of course I have sympathy for them, but they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. They shouldn't be there. What they're doing is not aid. It's not humanitarian. The whole humanitarian infrastructure is all about private profit. You're just connected to all the corporations that are funding the aid infrastructure, all the private military companies that provide security for the aid infrastructure. For example, DynCorp is involved in Sudan, and training the police in South Sudan. How can you say that South Sudan is not connected to Darfur when DynCorp is in South Sudan and the weapons are coming through Uganda from the United States, and they're coming from Kenya through the, you know, connections to the United States? And by the way, we forgot to mention for your listeners that those Somali pirates who took over that ship, the Pentagon was all over it. There were U.S. battle cruisers off the coast, but they couldn't take over the ship because I can't remember exactly why. There was some reason they couldn't take over the ship.
Hmm.
Because the ship took all these, the pirates took all these people prisoners as hostages. And the pirates made off with like something like, I don't remember what it was, $3.2 million.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is, the Pentagon ushered those weapons into Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
They made sure that they arrived in Kenya, and they made sure that they're going to go into South Sudan and make their way up there, you know? So the aid infrastructure of the South Sudan has always been. Operation Lifeline Sudan was the biggest aid operation in the world, and it was a billion-dollar operation for years,
mm-hmm.
almost 20 years, 15 years. And this is just private profit and capitalism. And for those people on the street in Toronto, you know, pull your head out of the sand. You know, enjoy your ice cream, and I will too. And enjoy our cell phones, because I have one. But we got to pull our head out of the sands, because basically, you know, the shit's coming down.
Mm-hmm.
It's written all over the walls. Things are going to get really ugly until people wake up and take control of our government, take control of the, and shut down these nasty corporations. And by the way, you know, one of the Canadian companies that's after me is Banro Corporation. Mm-hmm. They sent a nasty letter to one of my publishers and made him pull the articles off the website.
This is a mining corporation?
Banro is a Canadian gold corporation, gold mining corporation. I mentioned them in one of my stories about the Congo, and that's why they're after me.
Notorious. We have a third of all mining companies operate are from Canada, but Canadian-based.
Canadian mining companies are the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so are American.
Throughout.
So are Israeli.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all equally as bad.
They're all equally the worst.
Yeah. So,
but if people think Canadian companies are clean and safe and quiet and good and they're better than those Chinese, well, they have. That's another form of white supremacy.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And going on this aid topic, it's almost like feudalism, right? You give out the food, and then you hold the people sort of indebted in a inferior position, and also at the same time, what you're doing is subverting their local economies,
yeah.
Right? You're controlling the inflow of food and it's free food because the government subsidizes the U.S. farmers. Who produce? They don't produce commodities. They actually produce food to ship over the world to use as a weapon to subvert all the economies, keep the instability, and you know, usurp the resources.
You're absolutely right. When you set up an aid operation anywhere, I mean, look at the way. If anybody doesn't believe this, just look at the way that local police in any big city don't like food for food not bombs, bread not bombs. What was it called? Food, not bombs.
I think it's bread, not bombs.
Bread, not bombs. Anyway, they don't like anybody who sets up some little aid infrastructure to actually help people. It changes the way the economics work. And when you got a massive food operation, and we shouldn't call it food, because some of the stuff that's shipped in there is not food. When they set up these big so-called humanitarian private profit operations, it completely changes the dynamics of the local situations. And it creates dependency, and it subverts. It changes the economic situation between the local currencies and the dollar, for example, which comes with the food aid. And there's all these other pieces that are part of it, and people should read the book by Michael Maron, The Road to Hell, because that's the best analysis that exists.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, personally, coming from the doing work around Haiti, the Haiti Solidarity Movement. This is another prime example with particularly Canadian NGOs, or, you know, as we like to call them, GNGOs, operating in that country were directly responsible for the overthrow of the Ayrs state government and another democratically elected populist government, the first democratically elected government in the history of Haiti, or actually the second. There was one way back in 1804, the first independent black republic. But yeah, really the first elected government in Haiti that was overthrown by Canada, the United States, and France. And NGOs played a huge factor in this. Canadian Developmental Agency, the CEDA, directly funded all NGOs in Haiti that were operating against the government. Fake human rights organizations like we see operating in places like Sudan, and throughout Africa, putting out this propaganda about human rights abuses by the Aristide government. And this all culminated to support an armed insurgency that eventually, with the help of American Marines, overthrew that government.
Yeah, it's very true.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have much to say about that. It's very true. You know, we look at Zimbabwe as the case. The different factions in Zimbabwe that are funded and supported by the organizations in the United States connected to the CIA and connected to the USAID, which is another Pentagon. It's a soft policy arm of the Pentagon at this point. And it's important that people wake up to the fact that aid is just another business, that it's out to exploit people and it's out to provide jobs for white people who get the highest salaries and to cycle the money to and from white capitalist economies which don't give a damn about people in Africa or people of color or people in Haiti. So yeah, it's important to connect that.
Yeah, and I think even nowadays, it wouldn't even be hard to convince just someone on the street just how predatory, like, IMF loans are, just because of what people have seen with the whole lending and credit industry and how politicized it is and how much it just goes into corporate pockets, basically, right?
It's amazing how resistant we are to believing things when we've seen it happen over and over and over already, you know?
Mm-hmm.
People have all the evidence, but they continue to make the wrong choices. People need to make radical choices, and one of the radical choices people need to make is to recognize, or to ask themselves, are you going to sacrifice your children to save your body?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going on. We're sacrificing generations and generations to come to save ourselves, individuals.
Keith, one important point you made in the article you wrote just recently about these issues, the winter of Bashir's discontent, is around, and I'm not sure if you've already mentioned this, I was just out of the room for a little bit there, but is about, you know, we have this, a lot of propaganda coming out that somehow this new Obama administration in the United States is going to be anything really different for the masses of people in the third world, as well as those impoverished and exploited people right here in the North American continent. And I think, you know, the situation in Africa provides a very good window as to what little difference there will be between the former administration that just left and the new one. You describe, you know, many of the top Clinton officials that were involved in the terrorist campaign against Sudan back in the Clinton years, which included the bombing of a hospital, are now, again, top officials in the Obama administration.
Exactly. You know, I think there will be big changes, by the way, even though they will manifest in very different ways. They will not be any better for the earth or for the people of the earth. But I think there will be big differences between the two administrations. But the fact is, as you point out, there are a lot of people in the Obama administration who are directly connected to terrorist operations that have taken place previously under previous administrations, including especially the Clinton administration, but also, of course, the Bush administration's plural, father and son.
Yeah.
And these would be people we can name: Susan Rice, Roger Winter, and that's why I named it the Winter of Bashir's Discontent. People can read my article. It's you didn't mention my website, but if they want to find it, it's on allthingspast.com.
Right.
And they can read it and find out that Roger Winter helped to overthrow the government of Rwanda in 1994. He began in 1989. And then after that succeeded, he moved on, and they left Kagame there and moved on to start to subvert and overthrow the government of Khartoum, and succeeded in the sense that overtook South Sudan, and now they're working on North Sudan. And Roger Winter is deeply connected to Susan Rice and to John Prendergast, who's the International Crisis Group and was national security under Clinton, and to Walter Kanstiner, who was national security under Clinton. And, you know, a bunch of other people. So it's important to see that there are some, you know, if the Obama administration was going to be that different, it's time. It's time to make the changes. It's not to appoint the people that have done this stuff before and have committed these problems, for example, in the economic community. Mm. He's also got some people who are responsible for the economic crisis.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to get rid of them. Now. He's in government. Don't wait 2 years. You don't say you're going to take 50,000, you take troops out of Iraq, and then you say, well, we're going to keep 50,000 there. You're going to step up the war in Afghanistan, and then say you're, you know, you're for peace. Mm-hmm. This is the same George Bush, war is peace bullshit.
Yeah, yeah, and even you know, Democracy Now has done a good thing by what they've done is they've showed Obama over the years, going from his Senate speeches about single payer universal health care, campaigning this to all the people in his run up, and then even recently now he switches his tone. And he doesn't even invite one representative of that direction to the whole conference that he's having on healthcare. So you can see how it's just it completely morphs once you assume power, right?
Yeah, three cheers for Democracy Now.
yeah, I know.
Especially on Africa, I think as you pointed out, Keith, they've been horrible. But
oh yeah,
I
absolutely.
Didn't say that. You said that.
I'll say it too.
Yeah, we'll all say it.
Okay, so Keith, if there's anything that you want to add, any sources of information that people can go out and sort of get these things from, or anything, any final words?
Don't read the newspapers. Do not read the newspapers. This is what Henry David Thoreau said in 1857 or 1853. He said, do not read the newspapers. If you want to move forward in the world in a positive way, become a spiritual seeker. Don't read the newspapers. Don't pay attention to the propaganda. Shut it off, shut it out, exit the matrix. And people have to make radical changes, and it's not going to come from finding other sources. And that's the thing. People want an easy answer to the problems, and the easy answer is, well, what do I read? You know, where do I go? Mm. I could send them to my website, and, you know, you get information there, but even after you know that Roger Winter's committing this, you know, terrorism in Sudan, what's anybody going to do about it?
Yes.
We got to organize.
Yeah,
absolutely. And we got to organize here. And that's exactly why people who think that they should become Doctors Without Borders doctors and go abroad, or they should work for CARE, saving people in Africa, that's nonsense. It's more white supremacy. They got to stay here and change the system in the United States. But people want their travel and people want their adventures, and I understand that because that's how I got where I am.
Yeah, yeah.
The human nature, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, Keith, your website is allthingspass.com.
That's correct. Thank you.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of interviews with you on the Taylor Report, too. Another Canadian.
The Taylor Report and globalresearch.ca.
Yes.
Michelle Chosedowski, it runs a fantastic website full of a lot of good information. Project Censored, of course, is a wonderful project.
Right.
World War IV Report out of New York City is very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even our own Basics newsletter at basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com, linking local struggles to international one.
And which is exactly about struggling and bringing the struggle right here to the Canadian state and Canadian imperialists right here at home.
That's right.
Thank you so much for being on the program, Keith. We'll be sure to follow this up. And thanks so much for coming on today.
Take care. Thank you, too.
Thanks, Keith.
Have a lovely night. Bye-bye.
That was Keith Harmon Snow, journalist and photographer from Massachusetts, and he was just speaking about the situation in Sudan. We're just going to cut to a quick commercial break, and we'll be coming back with more from Massive and John.
Yeah, we are back. All right, so you just listened to Keith Harmon Snow, whose work on crises in Africa and how they are manufactured by the American state and the Israeli state and our own Canadian state, which... every single day, I'm more and more unproud to be Canadian. If you check out Keith's website, allthingspass.com, just type in his name. He actually does the research. He goes out to, he's been to Sudan, he's been to Africa, he's seen these crises, and you know, his work is, it's unparalleled. So, if you are tuned in right now to Catch the Blues, I don't know the name of the show, but the guy does a blues show, and he's not here. So we are going to have a whole another hour, and we are going to go back with the with John and Massive and Alok and Kabir, and we're going to do the whole, we're going to continue on with this No Cops thing, because this was a great discussion that we had to cut short, unfortunately, due to get Keith on. So also we're going to open up the phone lines if anyone out there wants to call in and you know, talk about some things, call in.
Yes, we're going to open up the phone lines a little bit later. You can call in and we'll give you a call back. But right now, we're just going to do a quick rundown, myself and Alok. You know, I think that before the break, we were talking about police in schools, police in Western Collegiate, the single so-called resource officer in Western Collegiate, and the kind of work he's been doing, the kind of resources he's been provided. He's providing the students, like choking teenage girls and pushing them out of the school. But I think that, I mean, this connects to a larger program of police brutality and police surveillance on certain communities. We have to remember that this police in schools measure is being put in place just a year after the Safe Schools Act. And anyone that went to school during that time, during the time of the Safe Schools Act, the six-year sentence from 2000 to about 2007, knows how devastating that program was. This program was put in place to deliberately kick kids out of school, to particularly black, brown, other racialized students out of school. Up to 80% of all expulsion cases in Toronto during that time, during those 6 years, were of non-white youth during the Safe Schools Act, suspended or expelled for things like swearing at teachers, you know, destroying school property, graffiti, fighting. And there was no process to get them back into school, no process to deal with the reasons that they were, you know, not to defend whatever actions brought them there, but nothing to address the root causes of the violence, of the anger. But instead, it was just pushing them out into the streets and deliberately putting them in a position where gangs and crimes would be the only problem. If you don't go to school, if you don't have a high school diploma, how are you going to eat in this society? How are you going to survive in this society? It's going to have to be through crime, through hustling, or through a minimum wage slave wage job. And so this is, I mean, we had a few calls talking about the crime situation.
Another thing is we should touch upon of students who are getting expelled and who have to consider their home as a street. We have to relate to that because that minimum wage job doesn't last forever, as we can see with this recession. I know for one, my mother is laid off. That's a fact. I know many mothers right now are laid off, and we have many single mothers who have 2 to 3 kids and can't give or put food on the table because they gotta at least hustle. What are they gonna do next? Like, they're gonna have to sell their body parts.
Yeah.
Like, what is Canada doing?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And I mean, that's a kind of condition that leads right to prostitution, right? Like all over sex trade workers and things like this. And even my dad too, he was laid off, right? Single parents, so it's tough. Anything else you want to add?
Well, isn't that same thing happening in LA right now? Mm-hmm. When prostitution is a big thing right now?
Yeah.
Crime violence has gone up because the gang, sex, violence, everything is because minimum wage jobs, people have nowhere to live, and they have nowhere to put food on the table.
Yeah, and it's even like you can check any stat, like wages have remained stagnant over the last 30 years, and the only way people reproduce themselves is either getting into debt or having to lower their quality of life by eating poor foods, you know, shopping secondhand, things like this.
Mm-hmm. And exactly, and so the system basically is designed to push people into a situation where crime is the only option. And then they make a case about, you know, violence. They create a hysteria among, you know, white communities. You know, when people like Jane Kriba get shot, suddenly the certain communities in Toronto that forgot about gun violence for, you know, 20 years are now suddenly afraid to walk the streets of Toronto, and there's a hysteria created that leads to the justification of police brutality. And of course, before the break, we were talking about just the regular harassment, the inferiority that's created by police towards youth in these areas, the authority that they seem to think they have and that they use to oppress and to repress other people. And of course, this breaks out, this daily harassment also at occasion peaks into murders, into outright murders and maiming, shootings, beatings of youth in these areas. And one case was that of Awi Al-Nadhir, that Alok, that basic community newsletter, we've been organizing around that with the family. The family's been leading that struggle again.
Well, just to give a little history behind the Justice for Awi campaign, Awi Al-Nadhir, just to give a personal background on him, he was a straight A student, or an A student, who aspired to be an engineer. He came from a wonderful family. He's got 3 wonderful sisters and 2 great, great parents, and, you know, a large family. You know, a kid had a great smile on his face, you know. Everybody who I've come into contact with him, who knew him, only had positive things to say about him. But I'd just like to give some description to the beginnings of the Justice for All We campaign, beginning with the night of Halloween 2007. So 18-year-old Awiel Alnadir was shot and killed by Toronto police. It was proven he was unarmed and his back was facing the police officer who shot him in the back of the neck. In immediate response to this incident, the family of Owe contacted us and Bad C, the Black Action Defense Committee, to attend Owe's vigil. Most mainstream press were invited and attended the very emotionally torn ceremony. Ironically, those media reports that followed some 2 weeks later did not resonate the grief-stricken sentiments poured by Owe's mother, family, and some 200 community members in attendance, who were seeking answers and justice for her son's and their son's murder. Instead, the Toronto Sun and the Toronto Star, the only mainstream media coverage of the incident, repeated the false claim that Owe was committing an act of armed robbery, which was a proven false claim made by the shooting officer. Owe's mother reiterated that it's not just about not justice for Owe, but the justice for his cousins, friends, and community members who face the routine threat of police harassment, intimidation, and from outright being slain for being a racialized body. This was the issue we began to organize around, and we approached the Regent Park South Community Center, a center in which Awi frequented, to carry a campaign launch. We had a verbal agreement to use the space and proceeded with distributing the entire Regent Park community with posters regarding the event. After trying to get in contact with the center numerous times and getting no response, we were finally contacted by someone at the center who informed us that their manager, Lucky Booth, declined the space for the campaign, saying that it is a touchy subject because we don't know what happened and that it was dealing with the police. We did some research and found out that her boss, Pam McDonald, was a vice chair on the Board of Police and Services. The same was the case with the Arab Community Center of Toronto. Only days before the conference, members of the J4A campaign were contacted and told that they would no longer be allowed to speak at the conference because of liability issues. Upon further investigation, members of the campaign learned that the ACCT is funded by Citizenship and Immigration Canada and also receives money from the City of Toronto. Furthermore, the RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, were among the panelists at the conference. So, beyond the constant harassment, driving while black phenomenon, there is a systematic and institutional form of racism, which we have to be, we have to be aware that police brutality is not an aberration, that this happened numerous times before and after Awi's death, with Jeffrey Ryotica, Byron de Basige, who stole two lemons, I have to stress that point, Sean Bell in America, and Oscar Grant in America. It occurs time and time again with intimidation, harassment for racialized men and women in low-income neighborhoods. Kabir, would you like to just give a brief description of the SIU's response to this? Or, let me just say that. The SIU, Special Investigations Unit, has dismissed this case, the Elwi case, and the Byron case without a proper trial or a fair trial. And have, only then after they've dismissed these cases have they issued, the ombudsman report with the certain reforms within the SIU, to demand a little more accountability. However, police in these neighborhoods are not accountable for their actions. They don't face judgment, which is why, they can continue to get worse and, act as, bullies. Placing them in schools to connect it with no cops, when the police are in these neighborhoods, the 13 at-risk neighborhoods, and they're terrorizing these kids and the community members, and this is seen upon the majority of people living there. How can you place these people in the schools that these kids from the communities attend and expect to build a trust issue when outside that school in the space where they live, they see the police routinely, going up to kids, hey, what's in your pocket? Hey, what's your name? This and that. Like, that's harassment, okay? And when the kid is just, chilling on the block, having a good time after Obama wins, celebrating, and then, anyways.
Yeah. Yeah, John Massive, anything you guys want to add to that? Maybe like any experiences or anything that you can think of?
Well, truly, I think government, everything leads up to something, right? Mm-hmm. And how do we get our drugs? How do we get our guns into Toronto?
Yeah.
Into Canada, basically. It has to pass through immigration, am I right? We go to America, we have to pass through the immigration.
Yep.
The other day, they had a big cocaine bus,
mm-hmm.
right? They said on the news that they've been tracking this for 1 year now. 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
You're telling me you have specialized dogs who are smelling this thing out. And now you find it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, it's true. It reminds me of a movie, New Jack City, where the guy is on trial, and they're trying to bring down the one figurehead, you know? And he says, ain't no Uzis made in Harlem, and nobody in here owns a poppy field. Right? He's like, this, it's bigger. It's bigger than this, right? And it's and also it feeds to the prison industry. Because in on the New York Stock Exchange, you can buy and sell in prison stock. You can literally buy a stock in prison. And how does that go up when it gets government funding? How does it get government funding? When it gets filled up and it's going to burst, right?
The prison industrial complex, and that exactly comes back to, you know, the reason we have police in the first place. It's just another part of the economy to create. When you go to jail, what you do, you work. But you work for nothing. You work for a few cents. You're not given a minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you're providing them almost free labor in prison. We forget that we still have slavery in America and Canada. It's just called the prison system. It's just called prison labor. In America, it's even more than in Canada, but it's expanding in Canada. They make license plates, everything you buy, wallets, everything that's made in prison. They do, you know, calls. What are those called? Marketing calls. That's all done in prison. And so the larger population you have in prison, and America being the largest prison population proportionally in the world, the more profit that generates. And right now, prisons are privatized. It's like another completely corporation. Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking about a youth jail being built in Brampton, that's basically just increasing capital for them. It comes back to capitalism and pushing these youth, putting them into a situation where they have to do crime, allowing them to do crime by flooding neighborhoods with drugs and guns. And then when they do that crime, locking them up in the prison industrial complex, where they're just going to, when they come out of it, when people come out of prison, they're not going to be, you know, scared straight, as they supposedly say. They're not going to come out of that prison and do good. They're going to come out of that prison with more knowledge on how to do crime. They're going to come out of that prison with now more associates that are also in the criminal life. They're going to come out of that prison and repeat the process of criminalization.
Also, when they come out of there, where are they going to be?
Mm-hmm.
They do not have no success of finding a job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Even if you want to change yourself, you will not be able to change yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a fact.
Yeah.
Okay? You have a criminal record. They ask you on a what is that thing
job
that you find?
Job
application.
Yeah.
They ask you, on the bottom of the sheet, they ask you, have you ever been in trouble with the police?
Mm-hmm.
Yes or no?
And you got to do a check. You have to go to the cops and
if you have, if you even put no, right? And you have had trouble with the police, they'll fire you.
Yeah.
So if I am a trustworthy man and I've marked yes, do you think I'll get the job? Like, people, put this in your mind.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's also like you said, right? It's tough to find a job, and then people have to resort to these things. Like, people have daughters and mouths to feed and things like this, right? And you've served your time. Like, you've done something wrong, and you go to jail and you serve your time. Why are you still paying the price afterwards, right? You in some instances can't leave the country. Like, you can't find employment, meaningful employment. Prison is not reform. Like we shouldn't kid ourselves in this. In a sense, right? Like, it's like Kabir said, you go and you almost learn to be a better criminal. And things like this. And the super jail. It's an $81 million super jail. Think about if they gave all the districts in Toronto $1 million for community centers, addiction, you know, job programs. Like, $1 million. Like, I don't know.
That's a huge super jail too, mind you. So, see the correlation between placing police in high schools where they're youth. And, you know, the opening of this youth super jail, which should be happening any month now. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's do a song right now. We'll take a break, and we'll come back and we'll build on this topic. So.